From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was the sound in the wee hours Sunday at Gerardo Barrio Square in El Salvador's capital, San Salvador, as Pope Francis announced the canonization of the late Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero, who was murdered by a right-wing death squad in March of 1980. This was Pope Francis making the announcement in Vatican City.
It's wonderful that among today's newly canonized saints, we have Archbishop Romero, who fought for people's well-being to the point of giving his life to protect the lives of those less fortunate. He always remained close to the poor and to his pilgrims.
For more on that, and first, an update on the elections a week ago Sunday in Brazil, we spoke with Tony Solo, a reporter from south of the border, via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua, Monday.
It was quite a shock to a lot of people that the right-winger, well, the fascist, Bolsonaro, got 46% on the first round. But I think in a way we shouldn't have been surprised, because Bolsonaro is very much the candidate of the United States and the Brazilian elites. And they've been pulling out, they've pulled out all the stops to try and get him a win on the first round. And so in a sense, I think there's a very strong sense in which that was a victory for democracy in Brazil, that they managed to prevent Jair Bolsonaro winning on the first round.
I mean, they kneecapped the opposition, or the so-called opposition, was actually the government until the coup there. But they first they removed Dilma Rousseff from office, the office she was elected to, and then they tell Lula you can't run, and they throw him in jail. So, you know, they were pretty much hobbled already, and yet they were able to stop this guy who's very charismatic, has the wall-to-wall support of the corporate media there, and except for his own, I don't know, he's got like political Tourette's. He couldn't keep his mouth shut about, gee, you know, Pinochet should have killed more people, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, and he is extremely obnoxious. And to give you some idea, and in his campaign addresses, when he's out stomping doing the electoral campaigning, he regularly praises the army officer who's still alive that tortured Dilma Rousseff.
Hmm.
And he's that in-your-face fascist.
And that guy's not in prison. I mean, that all by itself
No. This is an army officer who's, I think he's probably retired now. Jair Bolsonaro himself is a retired army captain.
Mm. From that era, huh?
And so he's, and his base is a mixture of, I mean, he projects, it's important for people to understand that what's happening in Brazil is pretty much a rerun in some ways of what happened in Argentina in 2015. What you had in Argentina in 2015 was Mauricio Macri pretending to be an anti-system candidate. You know, how absurd is that for somebody who comes from such an established family in the Argentinian oligarchy. But in Macri's case, he projected himself as anti-system. He was going to bring about change. And it's something that's really fascinating to me after watching this stuff for over 30 years. And regularly you get these right-wing parties running campaigns saying change. You know, so Macri's party was called Cambiemos, let's change.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they do is they project, they play on people's frustrations with the difficulties that the previous government may have had. In Argentina's case, it was the difficulties created by the international slump in commodity prices that was making the government's economic policies harder to implement to maintain living standards for the majority in Argentina. And so the right wing play on those difficulties, project that they're anti-system when in fact they're backed up to the hilt by local corporate elites and their US masters. right? And right. So what you have in Brazil is identical to that. You've got Jair Bolsonaro projecting himself as an anti-system candidate, claiming that all the politicians are corrupt, but the most corrupt are the left-wing politicians. And that, and so he plays on the fact that Lula da Silva is in jail, even though the majority of people in Brazil know very well that there's no case against Lula da Silva. So yeah, right. Bolsonaro plays on that. He plays on the need for a strong government. So strong government in it that will be able to bring about change. And because he is an evangelical Christian, he's also been able to play on the very extensive evangelical church base in Brazil, that unlike the evangelical churches elsewhere, for example, here in Nicaragua, the evangelical churches are far from right-wing, right? And large sections of the evangelical church here in Nicaragua support the Sandinista government and Daniel Ortega.
Right.
But in Brazil, it's true that the great majority of the evangelicals have a right-wing agenda, to the extent that Bolsonaro is even able to say things like, well, the poor deserve to be poor because God made it that way.
Right.
You know, and so right. And so he's able to get away with these extraordinarily obnoxious statements because of the different sectors of Brazil's electorate that he's been able to play on. So then, another thing to bear in mind about Brazil is that it's a huge country and it's incredibly politically diverse.
Yeah.
And in the Congress, as a result of those elections a couple of weeks ago, the biggest party is the Workers' Party. It continues to be the Workers' Party that is the biggest party in the lower house, but that's not very helpful because there are something like 32 parties represented in the lower house of the Brazilian Congress. And so Brazilian politics at that level in the lower house of the legislature is a complete lottery of who can set up the most stable coalition for the longest period of time, and that's like a complete kaleidoscope that changes constantly,
right?
Which makes politics at that level in Brazil very unpredictable. And if you look at the electoral map of support for the different political parties in Brazil, the tendency is to see that the south and southeast of Brazil, this is a cliche, of course, but it reflects a large extent the reality. The south and southeast of Brazil tend to support right-wing parties, and the north and northeast of Brazil, the poorer parts of Brazil, tend to support more progressive parties. And so in these elections, it was a debacle for the party of Michel Temer, the current usurper president who displaced Dilma Rousseff. That party basically collapsed, as well as a couple of other parties. The Workers' Party did really well to maintain its vote. I mean, and what was the percentage of the vote that Haddad got? Was it 29%, something like that?
Yeah, something that, yeah.
And that,
I don't know what the
ostensibly,
final
that, ostensibly, that makes it look as though Fernando Haddad and the Workers' Party have an impossible task, because they have something like, according to those results, they have a 15 to 16% deficit that they've got to make up in just 3 weeks. But although on balance the probabilities are that Bolsonaro is likely to win on the second round, it's far from clear that Haddad doesn't have a good chance. And I think we'll see over the next 3 weeks. And the second round runoffs in these elections are often very different to the results in the first round, especially in a country with such a diverse and complex political composition of political parties that make up the political spectrum. So I'd say it's, although it's likely that Bolsonaro, and he'd have to be really incompetent not to be able to make up the 5% that he needs over his first round result. But people are not necessarily in control of outcomes.
That's right. And you also have the consideration of turnout again. You know, that's the thing. It's not like they, in some places where you have ranked voting, everybody that goes out to vote once, and then they just process the results twice. This is a second vote weeks later. Not everybody, right. Not the same exact people don't necessarily show up. And sometimes there can be some, you know, real variations in turnout.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it depends. Will Haddad be able to mobilize on the basis of the fascist threat a sufficient number of voters from the people who abstained?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Assuming they don't just shoot him, which is not outside the realm of possibility, the way the game's been played.
Yeah, the before the first round, the polling companies were saying that on a second round, Haddad and Bolsonaro would have a dead heat. And that sounds very like what happened back in the 2014 election when Dilma Rousseff beat Aécio Neves, who was then the right-wing candidate. She only beat him by barely 2% of the vote.
Right, it was close. I remember that.
No, and that also reflects the reality in Argentina. Macri won on a runoff with barely 2% of the vote. And so it's by no means a foregone conclusion that Bolsonaro will win outright on the second round.
Yeah, and you know,
why do we care? Why does anybody care? Because Brazil's the biggest country in South America. It's like the 10th biggest economy in the world. That's why people care.
It's the BRICS.
So just in political and economic terms, that's why the result is hugely important.
Right.
But because it'll again tip the balance in either in favor of or against U.S. influence in South America. So if Bolsonaro wins, the U.S. will be able to kind of get virtually everything they want in terms of the way Brazil's foreign policy gets configured. Okay.
Yep.
So and if Haddad wins, they're likely to get the very opposite. Nothing that they want will be taken into account by Brazilian foreign policy. Brazilian foreign policy under Haddad is likely to be extremely nationalist and extremely progressive and trying to promote a multipolar world, whereas foreign policy under Bolsonaro government will be very much an effort to collaborate as far as possible with the U.S. corporate elites in maintaining South America as their kind of fiefdom with free access to the region's resources, both in terms of natural resources and in terms of cheap labor.
You know, when we're talking about a third of the population of South America, in essence, of 200 million roughly out of 600 million roughly in the region, and we're talking about also, for example, Brazil as one of the BRICS, when you talk about, you know, whether it's going to follow the path of multilateralism or appendage to U.S. imperialism, there's a global footprint that Brazil has in that struggle, aside from the, you know, very potent regional one. And this is like a big prize. That's a big chair that's being fought over.
Yeah, what else is happening in the region that kind of counters that? Well, and you've got Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's going to take the office as Mexico's president on December the 1st. And he has been making very strong noises in favor of prioritizing Mexico's domestic economy, prioritizing recovering Mexico's domestic oil production, which is currently dominated by foreign oil companies, talking about recovering Mexico's agricultural economy on behalf of small and medium-sized farmers, which happens to be one of the key areas that has enabled Nicaragua in particular Nicaragua, to defend itself against the recent economic attack by the United States. So, and if Manuel López Obrador, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, takes that kind of path, and that is going to be a very important counterweight to a possible Bolsonaro government in Brazil. But and another thing that has happened that's over the weekend that was very symbolic, for, especially for people here in Central America, about popular resistance to the kind of elite corporate attempts to claw back the influence and power and prestige and control that they've traditionally had in Latin America, which Jair Bolsonaro very much represents. Something that happened to counteract that over the weekend was the canonization of Bishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero, the Salvadoran bishop who was assassinated by the Salvadoran right wing, paid by the United States, supported by the United States, trained by the United States, armed by the United States. And they murdered Oscar Arnulfo Romero in 1980 when he was giving a speech in San Salvador's cathedral. And he was shot dead by a sniper.
Yep.
And so for years and years and years, he has been a kind of very charismatic rallying icon of the popular church and the liberation theology theologians here in Latin America call the option for the poor. And one of his most famous statements, one of Romero's most famous statements, and one that led him directly to his assassination, was that he said, it's inconceivable that the El Salvadoran oligarchy don't recognize the need to adopt the option for the poor. No, if you look at the history of the church hierarchy in Latin America, and it was like kind of this extraordinary statement against everything that the Roman Catholic Church had stood for, in particular in such a reactionary society as El Salvador, in a reactionary in an area dominated by reactionary oligarchies like Central America. So that was why they had to kill him.
Yep.
And so the fact that he's now been canonized by Pope Francis.
Right, from Argentina.
From Argentina. Somebody who himself has had a controversial history in his own country in terms of his involvement or non-involvement. There's a lot of controversy about his role during the Argentinian military dictatorship.
Right.
But the fact that that Pope from Argentina has canonized somebody totally identified with the kinds of struggles that are embodied by Lula da Silva and Fernando Haddad in Brazil, or by Cristina Kirchner and other more politicians in Argentina, or Evo Morales in Bolivia, or Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua.
Especially Daniel Ortega, right.
And Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. And people forget that a lot of these leaders are very, very very, very spiritual and religious in their approach. And so the fact that Pope Francis has canonized Bishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero has transformed Romero from a left-wing martyr into a mainstream saint.
He's a saint, that's right.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's very important in cultural terms in Latin America. People in the secular societies that exist in North America and Western Europe may not appreciate that.
Yeah.
But here in Latin America, it's a very big deal.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, it's even bigger than the span that you just described, given his own personal history, because when he was appointed archbishop in early 1977, the people who were involved in liberation theology were not enthused because he hadn't really shown any mettle in that area. And he was identified as someone, you know, more or less establishment, complicit, whatever. And then a month later, a friend of his, who's a Jesuit priest, was assassinated. And he said, You know, if that's what he got killed for, that's what I need to be doing. And he turned around. So he goes from being essentially right-wing lackey to liberation theological archbishop to saint. Well, to dead, and then saint. Martyr, and then saint.
Yeah, and you, that, there's something... It's impossible to know because one can't know what goes on in the minds of these figures. But the bishop here, the cardinal here, Cardinal Obando here in Nicaragua, he was regarded as effectively a CIA agent during the 1980s, mm-hmm. and then in the 1990s, he played a constructive role in reconciliation in Nicaragua, as did Daniel Ortega and some of the Contra leaders, in particular a guy called Comandante Franklin, Israel Galeano was his name, and who was assassinated for his pains trying to reconcile the Contra with the Sandinista front. And so through all that process, and Cardinal Obando came to change his mind, and he didn't adopt outright the option for the poor like Oscar Arnulfo Romero did, right. But he certainly became a figure who was extremely distrusted by the right-wing church hierarchy. And it was just, I thought it was really symbolic that he died right at the beginning of the attempted coup here back in April. Yeah. And the church hierarchy that he'd kind of kept under control, the fascist elements in the church hierarchy here, like the bishop here in Esteli, a guy called Abelardo Mata, and the bishop in Matagalpa, Rolando Alvarez, and another bishop called Silvio Baez down there in Managua. These three people are outright fascists, and they promoted the coup. And they are exactly the representatives of the church that detest figures like Oscar Arnulfo Romero, and they're the kind of church figures in the rest of Latin America, like the church hierarchy in Brazil, for example. Certainly the church hierarchy in Brazil, and to some extent, but in particular the church hierarchy in Venezuela, who are very much part of the fascist political opposition there. And the canonization of Oscar Arnulfo Romero is really a major ideological and moral setback for them. So then, I was particularly struck by the symbolism and the importance of Romero's canonization, because over the last week or so, I've been doing interviews with people in the health service here who were affected by the coup. You're talking about health workers who were threatened, health workers who were tortured by the opposition here. None of this gets reported in the international corporate media or by international human rights organizations.
Which coup are you talking about? You're talking about in Nicaragua?
Yeah, I'm talking about Nicaragua now.
Which coup?
And now? I did that. I'm sorry, John?
What you said, the coup. Which coup?
The coup here in Nicaragua, the attempted coup.
Oh, the attempted coup. Okay, yeah, gotcha. Back in April.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I mean, people here just talk about El
the
Golpe.
Coup. I gotcha.
The coup. But what they really mean is the failed.
Well, because there's so many coups that have actually been, you know, fully actualized.
So during the attempted coup here, health workers were very much a target of the coup promoters. Now, why was that? And we're talking here about a very small country of only 6 million plus people here in Central America. What you're actually talking about is something that is absolutely categorically relevant for the whole continent, because what the right-wing coup targeted was the public health system, the popular economy, everything that smacked of support for the majority, support for the impoverished majority. Why did they burn ambulances? And why is that not reported in the corporate media?
Right.
Why did they smash the windows of ambulances and kidnap and torture health workers? You know, why did they invade hospitals and kind of mother and child clinics and ransack them and wreck them. Why did they do that?
You know, well, these are the basis of both the political power of the Sandinistas and really the political power of the people. When the right says, why aren't you voting for us? They say, because we have health care. Boom. No, you don't. Because we have housing. Boom. No, you don't. Because we have access to food and education. Boom. No, you don't. They keep trying to destroy the public infrastructure that gets built up when the people have control of the government so that they can make the people essentially feel like they did all this work for nothing because they have nothing at the end of the day again.
Right. And so in these interviews that I did with people in the health service here over the last few days, I was repeatedly struck by the extraordinarily moral commitment of people at grassroots, you know. And you're talking about ambulance drivers who would have to negotiate roadblocks, every one of which they were threatened.
Mm.
Now, how many people would do that, and what possesses ordinary people to show that kind of moral resilience, you know, against fascist threats? Yeah. And it's what you were just talking about. They know they're defending something that belongs to them.
That's right.
They own it. That is for the benefit of them and their families. And that's where you get that extraordinary moral resilience from.
Right, that's right.
And that explains, in a very profound way, the link that ordinary people at grassroots feel to figures like Oscar Arnulfo Romero.
Right, that's right. You know, there's also, if you think about the role of religion in Marxist politics as it's evolved over the last century and a half, and the struggle in places like Latin America. You mentioned earlier, for example, you know, we've had this right-wing Catholic Church for so long, and a struggle, the rise of liberation theology, the smothering of it with the Polish Pope, etc. The alternatives that arise. Suddenly, some of the evangelicals take on a progressive political, and then they get involved in the political struggle, and so the left is engaged in a battle for the hearts and minds of religious peoples. And so when you suddenly canonize Romero in that context, that's like, you know, a checkmate on a one major game in a series of chess games.
Yeah, and I think that's a good summary of why Romero's canonization has not just a significance for people in El Salvador, people in Central America, but I mean, he has a continental significance.
Yeah.
That he might perhaps not have had before.
Yep. You know, it makes me wonder also what kind of moves he's making, if any, in Africa and Asia.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not up on the church in Africa.
Nor am I. I think it's something I'll look into that maybe we could talk about another time. We've got about 2 minutes left. Not even a minute and a half.
There is something that I feel very strongly about that we talked about before we began our conversation, before we began recording, and that is that, and if you look at, and going back to this whole issue of human rights, and why is the reality of what happened in Nicaragua and the reality of what's happened in Venezuela and the decades-long reality of Cuba, why is that reality not fairly reported in, or reported at all, in the corporate media? And why is it so distorted by international human rights organizations like the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights or the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, for example? And the reason, the fundamental reason, it seems to me, is that it's the same, in the same way that international financial organizations like the World Bank and the IMF are supposed to be aimed at reducing poverty. Of course they're not. Their agenda is dictated by Western corporate elites. And the same, because they have a neoliberal economic agenda. And all these human rights organizations, from Amnesty to Human Rights Watch to
all of them.
All these organizations have a neoliberal interpretation of human rights, which is designed to suppress the rights of the impoverished majorities around the world and promote the agenda of the Western corporate elites.
That's exactly
I think it's
right.
really important to understand that.
That's right. Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Good to talk to you.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.